Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Good morning, Michael Harding.
Good morning, Miriam. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
Listen, the sun is shining in Leitrim. There's daisies outside. It's good.
Paint a picture of your view for me.
Well, the view outside, I mean, we live in a wild area. It's not a lawn we have, it's a field, you know.
Mm.
But, I mean, there's hardwood woodland around us, and there's the garlic is in flower, and there's forget-me-nots in flower, and there's bluebells in flower. And yesterday evening I found a little bit of frohan, what they call the bilberry bush, and it comes into flower in the end of July, it comes into fruit in the end of July, but you get the little bell on it, like a beautiful little flower on it at the minute. So outside, that's what it looks like. It looks like a wild garden of hardwood trees, and Schlieveneeren is across the lake. And the lake is utterly beautiful this morning. Loch Allen.
Lucky you where you are. Now, I started to listen to your podcast. It's really good. Why did you decide to do a podcast? And how are you selecting what to put in it, Michael?
Well, I was when about the 5th of March or whenever this trouble of coronavirus began, I probably went through a period of 2 or 3 weeks where I was genuinely traumatized, afraid, very troubled. I was thinking, you know, I'm in my 60s. I'm vulnerable, and there was a real kind of sense of upset that the world is going to fall apart or change irrevocably. And so I went through that period of stress for a while, and gradually as the weeks went on, I just simply had an urge to tell stories. I mean, like I tell stories in books or I tell stories in the Irish Times, but It's a compulsion. Like if I was a monk, I'd want to pray because I'm a storyteller. That's all I want to do. And I felt just an urge to start dealing with the new media and to put up a podcast where I could tell more stories, reflections, meditations and all the rest of it. And I suppose also I thought it would be a good thing to do during the coronavirus time because storytelling can be a way of mindfulness. In other words, like whether you're telling the story or whether you're listening to a story works like a metaphor. It's like a poetry. It's a lens through which you experience the here and now more intensely. You come into the here and now because the story is like a plumb line. It goes deep into the present moment. And by listening to a story, by remembering, even remembering stories, like if you're talking to people who are over 60 or over 70 and you talk to them about their memories, in a strange way, the memories make you very joyful in the present because you feel grateful that you have the memory and that you're in the present. Mm. And that means that all the stuff to tell you about mindfulness, you know, about be here now, is very, 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 very helpful if you use stories. You come to the same place, which is a kind of sense of mindfulness or a sense of to be here now, as Thich Nhat Hanh used to say. To be here now really is the answer to everything, you know. It is to inhabit your heart with your mind. It is to allow your mind let go of all the perceptions and the intellectual stuff and just feel. You're with somebody else, or you're with the flowers in the garden, or the flowers in the pots on the patio. You feel a relationship with the world around you, and you feel it in your body, and you feel it in your heart. And that really is mindfulness. I mean, it's funny that they call it mindfulness, because in fact, it's really heartfulness. It's getting away from the mind and kind of living in your heart with the things that are around you, no matter how simple they are, and breathing and being aware of your breath. All that stuff is bliss. All that stuff, you don't have to achieve spiritual enlightenment in this life. All the things they say to try and achieve, you know, make yourself better spiritually, it's kind of not needed because you're already enlightened. You're already in heaven. If you just be still and be mindful and enjoy your breath and enjoy being here right now. That's, to me, anyway, that is That's where I come from, you know.
And that's really interesting. And I'm conscious, though, as well, Michael, say there are probably lots of people listening this morning who maybe find it difficult to get into that place you're talking about. Maybe they're possibly very worried about, you know, what's happening at the moment in the country. They could be worried about money or difficulties in their relationships. Speak to them for how they can get into this very, you know, calm place you seem to be in.
Well, in one sense, I can't speak to them because I'm not, you know, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a counsellor, I'm not a wise person in any sense. But I can only share my own experience. And my own experience in the past 8 weeks has been genuinely that there was 2 or 3 weeks where I was very, very distressed. It was like once again the world has fallen apart. And, you know, I thought I have to hold it together. It's my little world. And now, you know, will my health insurance, will I end up in a field hospital in the car park or some hospital in the city? Mm. You know, all that anxiety. I'm full of anxiety. I'm full of neurosis. I suffer depression. So I'm not in any way, the funny thing about me, I'm not in any way a calm person. But I do find that inside every storm, no matter how stressed you are, there is a calm. It's the most comforting thing in the world. Not that the world is divided into people who are cool and all collectively calm, and then on the other side you get people who are stressed like me. The real consoling thing I find is that in my experience of life, no matter what the ups and downs are, now I might call it prayer, but it's you can call it prayer or mindfulness or whatever you want. But when you go inside into the room in your own heart, when you go really deep into just being aware of the world around you, it is calm in there. It is good in there. There is no need to be afraid of being alone. That's all I can say.
And how did you, Michael, I mean, I've been listening to your podcast and it's, you know, really interesting because you talk about this on it and it is very comforting. But like you used to be, as many people know, a Catholic priest. And I think you were very interested, I suppose, in Tibetan lamas. How did you move from being maybe a depressed, stressed Michael to the place you are now? How did you do that? Or do you do that every day?
I think I do it every day. I stopped trying to live life as if you were getting away from a template of yourself that you felt was no good and you wanted to get to a template of the perfect me. And I began to accept myself.
Mm.
And in relation to, like, I started off with the Christian tradition. I enjoy and I'm enriched by all the other religious traditions, including Islam. I have a friend who's from an Islamic background and he's a beautiful ideas that come out of Sufi tradition in Islam. And they're the same as Buddhism. They're the same as Christianity. They're all saying the same thing. And that is, do not be afraid. Be in the center of your own heart. Be mindful. Be present in the here and now. And you'll realize this is heaven. This is heaven we're living in. So I come and go from that moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, up and down. It's not a question of the minute you, they say in Japan, the minute you name the bird, you cease to experience the song. And I think that's why all wisdom usually ends up in wrongheadedness when it gets into religion, because religions tend to get the wisdom, turn it into intellectual ideas or perceptions, and then insist everybody agree with these ideas.
Mm.
But the minute you're talking ideas, you've let go of the simple experience of mindfulness, of being here now. This is a mystery. You don't have to figure out about gods. You're living in it. It's in it and you're breathing it, and it's a miracle that you're here now.
Wow, people are saying, I could listen to Michael Harding all day, say lots of people texting in. Michael, how do you decide what you're putting on your podcast, which of course is Michael Harding? I think you get it first of all on Patreon, is that right?
Yeah, Patreon. It's a way of doing a podcast. I know I don't have it on iTunes and I don't have it on Spotify. It's only on Patreon. And the reason for that is that people make a contribution, maybe a euro or up to maybe 5 euros a month. So it's like 2 cups of coffee to buy me every month. But the reason is that you don't have a sponsor, there's nothing commercial about it, and it becomes a personal collaboration. So the people that are supporting me, I feel a personal relationship with the listeners because they are supporting me in my creativity as a storyteller. And the way I get the stories, you know, to be honest with you, it's exactly the same way as I would do the columns in the Irish Times. I just wait to see what surfaces. I don't have a plan, or I don't say, oh, I'm going to do some idea. I just sit and wait, and some memory comes into my mind, like some friend that I remember from 30 or 40 years ago that I was very fond of. And I just start usually moving into it intuitively. In other words, if you hear my podcast, you're hearing me talking off the top of my head about memories and stories and things that happened. There's no agenda.
No, but
the real agenda, I suppose, is that you can use stories in your own life. If you're sitting around and you're confined with the family and all the rest of it, to talk stories is to evoke the past. And to evoke the past is like a plumb line into the present. It kind of creates a lens through which we become more aware of being here now. And that is what all art is about. All storytelling is about this dynamic in culture to allow us inhabit our life here and now more deeply, more beautifully, and to live with metaphors on the surface. And again, that's what religion used to do. Religion was metaphor until people began to misunderstand it and think it was a kind of a set of intellectual ideas.
Well, our listeners, Breda in Limerick says, woke up feeling sad and lonely and alone this morning. I now feel calm listening to Michael on the radio. Thank you, Michael. Another, Claire, says, I adore Michael. He's funny, thoughtful, often deep. Hope he's writing away to another book, is long overdue. Can you mention my pal Anne, who's cocooning in her greenhouse marina, and her sister Maeve too? We all went to see Michael in the Helix when one could roam freely. By the way, is there any room in Leitrim for me? It sounds idyllic.
There's plenty of room in Leitrim, and I'll be touring again in the autumn, and I'll have a new book in the autumn, which is simply about memories of going to the seaside. And the sea is like, what a thing the sea is all around us. Even if you're in Dublin, you're right beside the sea, the Irish Sea. Mm-hmm. There's nowhere in the country except, I suppose, Mullingar, where you could say, I'm not near the sea. And even in Mullingar, like, it's okay. You're only about an hour and a half from the ocean.
Absolutely.
And it's like everything is about, you know, there's a philosopher, Pinker, and he was on Channel 4 recently, and he was talking about how the universe is indifferent to, you know, the coronavirus is eating us and the universe is indifferent and we've got to get used to it. But in actual fact, this is a kind of an arid intellectual secularism, and the space for poetry is to go out and look at the mountain and realise the trees in my garden are not indifferent. There is a relationship between me and them, and it's them. I don't call them it. You know, I don't say it. I say them. I have a relationship like I have with an other person. And bringing that relationality back into our culture, I think, is going to be part of the future. And that's poetry. And that's religion. And that's religion without rules or without dogma. Ezra Pound said dogma was just bluff based on ignorance.
Yeah, you're very soothing, Michael. That's what all our listeners are saying. Keep him on. He's very soothing. But listen, Michael, as I said, I'm going to bring you back on in a few weeks because you are very soothing and our listeners are loving you. But just to say, your podcast, your new podcast, Michael Harding, and It's Very Soothing, is out on the Patreon. And again, it's Patreon platform if they'd like to listen to it. Have a lovely day in Leitrim.
And you'll be asked for a euro or... Go on. A euro or whatever, but I mean, I appreciate it. I mean, again, it's a way of me surviving because this is how I survive, by telling stories.
Yeah, and you tell them so well. Michael, stay well. Enjoy looking out there in Leitrim and stay well and chat soon.
And thank you. And just, you know, happy day, no matter what the suffering is that you're in at the moment. May you just be blessed, you know.
Oh, thanks, Michael. Everyone will love you saying that. Mind yourself, Michael.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care, mind yourself.
Emma Donoghue is one of our finest writers. You'll know her novel Room, of course, for which she won an Oscar nomination for the screenplay. Well, a new novel Emma has been working on long before the current COVID-9 outbreak looks at the flu pandemic of 1918, and it's been brought forward by her publishers. And I'm delighted to say that Emma joins me now from her home in Canada. Hi, Emma, how are you?
Hi, Miriam. Hi, Ireland.
Are you missing Ireland in the lockdown?
I am, you know, because I usually visit a couple of times a year, and it's very odd to just not be able to, you know?
Absolutely. What's it like in Canada at the moment, Emma?
I would say things are fairly calm where we are in Ontario. I mean, it's been brutal in the care homes, basically. But in the wider community, not as bad. For instance, we have a local sort of field hospital built for lots of COVID patients, but they haven't needed to use it. So things have a kind of weird calm to them, I would say, if you're not one of the frontline workers.
And do you still have restrictions there?
We do. We don't have a set number of kilometres or anything, but we're meant to be basically staying at home unless we need to go out, you know.
I suppose as a writer, do you find that less difficult than other people? Because I suppose...
It's not hugely different from my normal lifestyle, yes. I realise most people are perceiving this as, you know, a horrifyingly restricted way of life, but it is pretty much how I spend my time, yeah. So, I've just been chugging along, you know, writing as usual. A little bit more distracted, obviously, by the fate of humanity. So there's been a bit more Netflix binging to get me through. But, things have not been that different. I'm very used to just, you know, living in my head for much of the time and not roaming around much. But, you know, I've always had periods of travel to break that up. So it's an odd feeling to feel I have to hunker down and, above all, not see friends. Because usually I would rely on socializing to kind of provide all the interest that other people maybe get from their office job.
And it's interesting, isn't it, Emma, that you have been working on this book, which, you know, is about the flu pandemic of 1918.
Oh, it couldn't be stranger. Yes, I started The Pull of the Stars last year, prompted by the centenary of the 1918 flu, and I just finished it when COVID hit. So it couldn't be stranger, and it feels a little indecent to be trying to sort of sell anything in the current climate, you know. But my publisher said, look, now is when we should bring it out. And I suppose, sure, if we wait till next year, everybody might be sick of the subject. So, yes, we're going ahead. But I suppose one thing I like about publishing this book this summer is that it's all about nurses and doctors and the incredible motivation of people who just get up and walk into danger day after day when most of us are huddling away from it, you know. It's mostly fictional characters. It's set in a fictional Dublin hospital, but it does star the great Dr. Kathleen Lynn as the only real historical character.
Remind people of Dr. Kathleen Lynn, Emma.
Well, she's extraordinary because not only was she a sort of an advanced public health person in that she did campaigns, she set up a children's hospital, St. Dalton's, at a point where most hospitals wouldn't take in the children of the poor. She had campaigns against, say, TB, she campaigned for nutrition, but she was also a Sinn Féin leader and involved in the 1916 Rising. So she's, you know, her career kind of intersects the women's movement, the labour movement, the Republican movement, and then all the issues of how to make a state that would cherish all our children equally. So she's an extraordinary figure, and I've been very interested to see the campaign to name the new children's hospital after her. I couldn't imagine a better way to name it.
And it's interesting, isn't it, Emma, when we look back that even when we were in school, a lot of the heroes or heroines we heard about, they were mostly men, weren't they? So Kathleen Lynn is...
Entirely. Yeah, Mother Teresa and a lot of men, basically. And of course, Kathleen Lynn, you know, clashed very often with, she clashed with the Catholic hierarchy. They saw her as an interfering Protestant. I mean, even, you know, I'm casting her as a novel, as a doctor who's been brought in temporarily to the hospital, and a lot of the hospital staff are like, who's that weirdo, you know, with the police after her. As a member of the Sinn Féin executive, and they would have seen her as a complete troublemaker in that she was a suffragette and socialist and wanting to make a better world.
Did you have to do a lot of research for this book?
Yes, I do a lot of research for everything I write, but this one, obviously, because it's about real medical things, I have to keep checking. I mean, even now at the proofreading stage, we have heated debates about, you know, you know, morbid questions like exactly how long might it be possible to get a baby out if the mother drops dead when the baby's at full term, you know? Mm-hmm. And lots of ways in which medicine was different in 1918 to now. For instance, you know, we can very actively treat things now and we can analyze a virus, say. They didn't know what viruses were. They were all still looking for a bacterium. They were mostly treating the flu with whiskey. And they were just stumbling around in the dark. And the one thing that all the doctors admitted was that only good nursing brought people through in the 1918 flu. You know, just enough nursing that people's own immune systems could fight it off. So it's a very good pandemic to write about in that they were so powerless, but they tried so hard. You know, the sheer gallantry of the nurses and the doctors.
Which is what we're seeing right now across the world as well, isn't it, Emma?
Just, I have a niece who's a nurse, and I you know, if you have a job like writer that's less directly impacting people's lives, it's hard to understand how you could be motivated enough to just walk into danger over and over, and even though you're bringing the danger home to your own families.
It's so different in one way, I suppose, to what we're going through now with COVID-19, but were there similarities at all between the flu pandemic in 1918 and what we're seeing now?
Definitely. There was an atmosphere of sort of generalised fear. There was lots of quite confusing notices from government saying things like, if you feel ill, lie down and rest for 2 weeks. And you're thinking, you know, how can the poor do that? Eat lots of food. But then they would also have a bit of wartime warning, like, don't eat too much food, you have to share. So very confusing messages, sometimes reliance on absurd quack cures, you know, like Trump. And they would suddenly say, eat onions, eat a raw onion a day and you'll be fine. So the same kind of atmosphere of confusion and frenzy and scientists battling to be heard over politicians, basically.
Tell me, I suppose, also, Emma, about the Ireland of your book. I mean, I suppose the First World War just ended, but the deprivations of that and maybe what the lives of men and women were like.
Yeah, well, one reason I said it in Ireland when I could have said it anywhere, you know, it was an absolutely global pandemic that killed 2-3% of the world population. If most people in 1916 were bewildered by what were those Egypt's doing during the rising, you know, a few years later, they were all voting for Sinn Féin. So there was an astonishing kind of cultural shift in those years. And via Kathleen Lynn, I decided to look at it in terms of injustice, really, that this Ireland they had was clearly an unfair country where the slum life in Dublin was just, they described it as the Calcutta of Europe, for instance. They couldn't find any equivalent within Europe. They had to turn to India for an equivalent. The death rates among children born in Dublin, for instance, the maternal death rates, by every measure, Ireland was really, really struggling. So I can quite imagine that idealists like Kathleen Lynn would have said, you know what, even though I'm a doctor, I actually have to turn to the gun to make some difference to my poor country.
Wow, when you look back, and it's not that long ago, really, sure it isn't.
Not a bit. And it's funny how many things are, you know, specific to the time. Like, for some reason, the government advice, they were obsessed with kisses. They would say things like, if you must kiss, kiss through a handkerchief. You know, nowadays we're you know, trying to keep a 6-foot imaginary span around us. So the details differ, but the atmosphere of fear and the sort of exposure of underlying inequality in society is the same. Because, of course, you know, the rich could afford to stay home, lie down for 2 weeks, be nursed tenderly, sip their beef tea. And the poor were, you know, just struggling to get on with their lives.
I was reading in preparation for this interview, Emma, about your mom and her diaries. And I think it's maybe almost 2 years ago since you lost your mother.
That's right. And, you know, not only is she still a lovely voice in my head, you know, but I'm lucky enough to have her diaries, which are, you know, she'd have laughed at the word diary, that they're just little day agendas. Sometimes they're only about 2 inches square. And they say things like, have a haircut. And then there'll be a line slashed through a haircut and it'll say, raining didn't go. You know, so there were a mixture of what she was meant to do that day as a busy mother of eight, you know yourself, Miriam, and what she actually got done. And They're fascinating little jottings. The style is almost telegraphic because she was that busy, but she'd put in little glimpses of what the kids were up to, or, you know, you'd see how an illness like the measles would just sweep through the Donoghues. You know, she'd think it was over and then another two children would start getting sick. So they're an amazing document from the 50s right through to the 2010s, and I'm so glad she left them to me. So now I'm basically trying to kind of decipher them, go through and try and make sense of her handwriting and see, for instance, what films she saw that year, what books she was reading.
It's a lovely gift that she gave you, isn't it?
It is, and she handed them to me in her 70s and said, do what you like with these when I'm gone. So I feel I have her blessing.
Oh, that's so special, actually. And listen, there's a short poem you loved. I didn't know this poet even. Tell me about this poem you're going to read.
I've never heard of him before, but, you know, in an era when most people don't read much poetry, I have to say Facebook and other social media will occasionally manage to get a whole new audience for a poem. So this one just devastated me, because nowadays we're talking a lot about how vulnerable the old are, you know, as if they're some amorphous mass. So I love when I come across something that manages to individualize somebody in old age and take their griefs and their fears seriously. And it's a poem by an American writer called Michael Mark, called Celebrating His 92nd Birthday, the Year His Wife Died. He goes to Ben's Deli because the waitress doesn't ask how he is. He takes most of the corned beef from the sandwich, piles it on the edge of the plate, makes a thinner one with enough left for two nice ones at home. The waitress packs his leftovers, extra slices of rye and half-sour pickles in waxed paper, and two mustards in squat cups. She never removes the other setting. She lets him sit as long as he wants.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Sorry, you think I could get through a short poem on air without crying, but there must be so many people out there trying to get on with their lives, and when they've just lost somebody. And when you see some people talking about how, oh, the old don't matter so much because they're closer to death anyway, you know, it just sickens me at the moment the way, you know, young people go on social media saying, oh, let's be sensible about the death of the old. They would have died anyway, you know?
Yeah, no, you're so right, Emma, and sensitive, because it's such a beautiful last line.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Kind of says it all.
Say a thing about his feelings, you just deduce it all from the fact that he doesn't want the other place setting taken away.
You're lucky in your own life because you found great love, didn't you? And you together, I know you have two children, Una and Finn, haven't you?
Yes, and Chris and I are thrilled that this year we got around to parties in a big way. I had a big party for my 50th and I had a big party for our 25th wedding anniversary. So,
happy anniversary and happy birthday.
Never with a wedding, but 25th anniversary. So anyway, now when we're not allowed to see other people, I mean, I'm glad I have the four of us in the family, but I'm thinking back to parties and going, oh, amazing, the house filled with people dancing. Look forward to that happening again sometime.
How are Una and Finn? How old are they now?
They are 12 and 16 now, our daughter and son, and I have to say they seem to be thriving. I mean, it's a bit dull for them, cooped up with us adults all the time. But a lot of laughter is still being had, and they're doing their, you know, home education at home via the internet. Thank God for the internet. And we're all watching a lot of telly, and I'm reading Una and Terry Pratchett novels, which are just perfect because they're so funny and they're so erudite. You know, he always has a few words in there I don't know, so you feel it counts as English class at the same time as passing the time.
Emma, do you stay in touch with home? Like, do you keep looking at what's happening here, or do you, when you're away, keep away from Ireland?
No, I do stay in touch. You know, I have a friend who lives near the Phoenix Park, for instance, so in a way, her photographs are giving me a little glimpse of deserted Dublin every day. I stay in touch with friends and I have ongoing working relationships, say, like with Element Films, who are having such a fabulous hit in the moment with Normal People, aren't they?
Absolutely.
I'm doing a film of The Wonder with them, so she'll feel very much part of Ireland.
What's that project you're doing with Element?
I'm doing a film of The Wonder, my last novel, my novel before last, with Element, because I had such a great experience working with them on Room. So working relationships with people you really click with because you share that cultural understanding, that can make you feel whole even if you're an emigrant, you know?
Yeah, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, we're probably going to go out in a piece of music. You mentioned two to us. You love Giants in the Sky, which is a Stephen Sondheim piece, but you also mentioned that gorgeous song, Mad World.
Yep.
Which is beautiful. Why do you love it?
Mad World, it's funny, I'd known it since the 80s, but I heard an acoustic version just recently and I thought this could have been written about the shutdown right now. It's got that eerie sense of, you know, things going crazy all around you in this chilling and melancholic way. So it somehow seems to capture the atmosphere of the pandemic better than any more recent tunes I've heard.
Well, Emma, as ever, thanks so much for talking to me. I really look forward to reading The Pull of the Stars. It's just so apt. And we'll go out listening now to Mad World. Thanks so much, Emma. Mind yourself.
You too, Miriam. Bye-bye.
Take care.
All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces, bright and early for the daily races, going nowhere, going nowhere. Their tears are filling up their glasses, no expression, no expression. Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow, no tomorrow, no tomorrow. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad.
That beautiful song there, Mad World from Gary Jules, Emma Donoghue's choice there. Well, look, as you'll know, one of our finest poets, Yvan Boland, died on Monday. Many of you would have loved her poems, such as Quarantine and Night Feed. And in 2016, I had the great pleasure of interviewing Yvan for this programme. And we spoke then about how Ireland has changed.
We have that wonderful thing that in Ireland, all radio is local radio, all television is local. The meaning of the local is so fresh and intense here, and that's just a huge gift to a country. And I think there's a quality of life here that is hard to find in other places.
Like what? Just the pace of it?
I think it's the way people behave. I do think there's still that old harking back to the informal neighbourly way of living. If you go to the bank or if you go to a shop or you go, you know, there's something about that that is still there.
And in terms of, I suppose, identity or Irish identity, are you happy or sad about any changes that have happened to Irish identity that you've witnessed in your own lifetime?
Oh, I'm very glad. I am. I mean, I, like everybody else, was so thrilled at the vote for gay marriage. It was enormously admired in where I was in California. I'm very glad. When I was younger, I thought there were a lot of wonderful things. It was a great literary tradition. But the treatment of women and the dark shadows over things like the Magdalene Laundry will always be a stain on the country, I think.
And of course, a lot of writers today write about domestic life, about motherhood, but you did that before many people. And you once said that when you began writing about motherhood, you felt it was easier to get the balm into an Irish poem than the baby. Remind people why that was.
Well, I think people felt, strangely enough, in my book, that having a bomb there was part of the great heroic tradition. Having a baby there was just a complete degradation of the tradition. And I mean, it was hard to get the dialogue going that would say to people, look, this is the way we're going to have to think about the future. If you have a group of people who feel they can't put the objects of their lives into the poems, it is poetry that's going to suffer. So I think eventually, you know, it was a little difficult for people to move.
And in terms of poetry, I suppose if somebody's listening this morning and maybe they're struggling to pay their mortgage or they're worried about illness or a child of theirs, what is the use of poetry?
Well, it's not certain that poetry would do anything practical. It doesn't change events, but it does change people. And I think, you know, there are poems that I've brought with me and remembered and will always remember. and have been companions to me. And I think poems do that.
And we're going to take one more poem from you, Yvan, and it's a poem you've chosen. I think you wrote it for your daughter, Yvan. It's called Legends. And I suppose it's really about the continuity of human life across generations, or is it?
Oh, yes, it is. Her name is my name. She was named Yvan. It's the idea of legends, and it seemed to me very nice to be able to read it just at this time. She's about to have her second child, a second grandchild, and that will be another form of continuity. This is Legends for Yvan. Triers of firesides and twilights, there are no tears in these. Instead, they begin the world again, making the mountain ridges blue and the rivers clear and the hero fearless, and the outcome always undecided, so the next teller can say begin and again and astonish children. Our children are our legends. You are mine. You have my name. My hair was once like yours. And the world is less bitter to me because you will retell the story.
It's a beautiful poem. She must love it herself, does she?
She does.
Yeah.
She does, and I'm so glad she does.
That was Yvan Boland speaking to me in September 2016, Colossal of Yvan. Well, as we all know, Paul Brady is one of our most brilliant singer-songwriters, and he isn't wasting a moment of the lockdown because he's recording and releasing a new song which he's written with the great songwriter Sharon Vaughan. And Paul joins me now from his home. Good morning, Paul.
How are you, Miriam?
I'm grand. Tell me about this new song. It's really lovely.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, it's a song that I finished around about Easter. Aaron and I started writing it about a year and a half ago. But like a lot of times when, you know, we don't finish things off, and I decided this was a good time to finish it off. And the morning I finished it off, I played it to Mary, my wife, and we were planning the song as a kind of an adult love song in a difficult time. But she said it could just as readily be a song for a new life coming to the world. And as it turned out, our great friend Philip and Nicola Flynn, their son Evan and his wife Kelly, had just had a new baby the morning I finished the song. So I thought, yeah, the song is just as good as a new life song, you know.
And it is beautiful, and people will see what you mean by that at the end of it. We're going to listen to it now, Paul, if that's okay. This is your great new song, It's a Beautiful World.
Thank you.
Masks on our faces, bad news on the radio, guns in the classroom, lessons in doom, flames in the forests, poisoning the air we breathe, memories of roses too burned to bloom. I'll just keep on thinking this whole world is beautiful. How can it not be when you are here? I'll go on believing people can be wonderful. Each time you're close to me, it's clear. It's a beautiful world now you are here. And if I appear delusional, my optimism doesn't mean I'm not aware or I don't care. But I'll just keep on thinking this whole world is beautiful.
can it not be when you are here? I'll go on believing people can be wonderful. Each time you're close to me, it's clear. A whisper of hope to calm my fear. It's a beautiful world now you are here.
Yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful. And the baby at the end. That's your new song, It's a Beautiful World. It's a really beautiful song. Actually, we were sitting here, myself, Sian, the producer, and Mark and Artie. There aren't many people here. And we're all saying, you're such a beautiful voice, Paul.
Yeah. Well, totally untrained, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Oh, maybe all the better for it. And our listeners saying, Paul Brady has made my Sunday morning that bit better.
Ah.
And everyone's saying, that song is just too small a word for it. It's absolutely brilliant. Please thank him for such a beautiful, thoughtful song.
Can I just dedicate it to anybody who's brought new life into the world in the last, since we've been in lockdown? Because it's a scary world, and just like to wish them all well.
That's a lovely idea. How are you dealing with lockdown? You're missing swimming, aren't you? You're a big swimmer.
Yeah, well, I mean, my main exercise is swimming, like 3 times a week, of, you know, 25-meter pool, 30 lengths, you know. And now I've been locked in for over a month, and that's hard. But, I mean, you know, the weather's been good, and it's given me an opportunity to get back and finish stuff and write songs. And, you know, I'm not the worst off.
Yeah, and do you find it conducive to being creative this time? Or, you know, I mean, are you a worrier, or do you just think, I'm here, I'll just be as creative as I can be?
Well, I mean, I'm just like most people, I'm just living one day at a time, you know. I mean, okay, so we've had a bit of a roadmap now, so I'm going to be let out of the house next Tuesday, apparently. But I'm living one day at a time, and, I mean, you know, it's not a quick case of worrying whether you're going to die or not, particularly. It's more like, will we ever get back to what things were? I mean, like, you know, travel, for instance, you know, I mean, our kids are down in New Zealand, and we're kind of going, when will we ever get there again, you know?
Yeah.
And so those things are the things we don't know. So there is a kind of a low, an anxiety around society, which I'm no stranger to myself.
Yeah, but I mean, actually, I suppose a lot of people I've spoken to, whether, you know, it's anxiety or that once you're creative like you are, a lot of people, whether you're a poet or a writer or a musician, that does allow you in some way, doesn't it, to release anxiety through your work?
Well, yes, certainly. It gives you something to do, and it gives you a sense of satisfaction, and it gives you a sense of, well, you know, there's a reason that I'm here, and no matter what's going on, you know, I just keep doing what I'm doing, and that's the way you get through it, you know.
But you know,
I am lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that?
Well, I am lucky. Yes, that I have. That, I mean, for a start, on a practical level, I'm lucky my studio is in the garden, so that I can actually go and do some work. I know friends that who work different places and they can't actually go to it. You know, being creative friends.
Yeah.
So I am lucky from that point of view. The studio. Just across the garden, you know.
I've been lucky enough, though, to interview down the years a good few times. You're so modest, Paul Brady. I was looking at your roll call of the songs you've written. I mean, if anyone had written one of those, they would think, that's amazing. I mean, The Island alone, as you know, I'm obsessed. It's such a beautiful song. But you've never lost the run of yourself, as they say.
Well, you know, that's probably an accident.
No.
I don't know, you know. I mean, I've always kind of skirted around the periphery of fame, and I've never felt comfortable in that arena at all. And maybe that's been its own protection, you know. Not everybody knows me, but that means I'm sort of, I escape criticism.
No, everyone knows your brilliant songs. We're going to listen to another song now of yours, Paul. You suggested this as well. It's from your latest album, Unfinished Business. It's a gorgeous song called Oceans of Time.
Yeah, that's a song that, coincidentally, actually, it's another co-write with Sharon Vaughan. Mm. I mean, she comes to Ireland every couple of years and we write three or four songs and then I don't see her for another couple of years. But this was one which we put together for the last album.
Let's have a listen.
Come every day, it's sink or swim. Take it to heart, all on a whim. Are we the loser or the hero? It's a dice throw. So what if we lose our focus? Nobody's gonna know. Oceans of time will wash on by, ebbing and flowing through our lives. Why should we hurry up the tide, you and I? Only have oceans of time. Sunrise to sunrise, it's a game. 24 hours, it doesn't change. No point to beg, steal or borrow from tomorrow. Whatever we need, we have it. Let's not get stuck in traffic. Oceans of time will wash on by, ebbing and flowing through our lives. Why should we hurry up the tide, you and I? Only have oceans of time.
Another beautiful song. If I was to read all the love online for you, everyone's going, oh, I love Paul Brady. Please ask Paul Brady to sing any song. Someone else goes, Nadine goes, that man is ageless to me. Yeah, everyone loves you, Paul. So I'll have to give you a big head since you don't have one.
Can I just say that the new song is available free as a free download on my website, paulbrady.com.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah.
And that's that beautiful song, It's a Beautiful World.
Yeah, that's correct.
Paul, as ever, thanks so much for joining us. We might chat again in a few weeks. Stay your wonderful self. My thanks to Sound Today, to Mark Dwyer, to my producer, Sian O'Gorman. And we'll go out listening to just a little bit of the Lakes of Pontchartrain. And I'd like to dedicate this to anyone who's lost someone. And I'm thinking today also of my own dad, whose anniversary it is. Thank you.
was on one bright March morning, I bid New Orleans adieu. And I took the road to Jackson Town, my fortune to renew. I coursed all foreign money, no credit could I gain, which filled my heart with longing for lakes of Pontchartrain. When I stepped on board of a railroad car beneath the morning sun, I rode the roads to